Hello, welcome to the Netzpolitik.org podcast. My name is Andre. I'm at CPDP Conference 2015, and our guest today is Phil Zimmermann. Hey, Phil.
Hi.
Who are you, and what do you do?
Well, I'm a cryptographer. I'm probably best known for my work in encrypted email with PGP, which I published 20 years ago. But in the past decade, I've been working on secure telephony. So if you want to talk securely with no wiretaps, then I can help you with that.
Thanks for that. We've been avid PGP, OpenPGP users for many, many years and advocating it, especially after Snowden. It became easier to convince people to use it. Back in the 90s, after you wrote PGP, we had this thing called the crypto wars. Briefly explain what that is and how you think the outcome you perceived was. And because the running gag was that we all said we won the first crypto wars. Did we win?
Well, we won within the narrow scope of what we were trying to accomplish, which was to eliminate the export controls in the United States, the domestic controls in France. Britain had sort of a combination of those two, and other Western European countries had sort of smaller versions of that. But we presented a kind of a united front on both sides of the Atlantic, and we were able, by the end of the decade, to push back pretty much all the controls on cryptography.
What we gained, if I remember correctly, was the ability to use strong algorithms, strong key material, and the ability to use programs like PGP and cipher and protocols like TLS, SSL, which back then were under some kind of export mechanisms. We were only allowed to use 56-bit keys, so the NSA always has a way to break them. We perceived that as a win because we advocated, okay, now it's free, open, easy to use, privacy for everyone. And one of our core arguments also was the economy needs it. There's not going to be any banking without secure encryption
e-commerce.
On the internet. E-commerce, that was a thing back in the 90s. That word hasn't been used ever since. But but then with the Snowden revelations, we learned that he also said strong crypto works, but the NSA frequently has ways around it. Yeah. So did we actually win, or did the NSA still work around?
Well, again, I think that within the confines of the objectives that we had in the crypto wars, we did win that. But NSA, after a while, NSA stopped pushing because I think they understood that they had other ways to get what they want. And today we know from the Snowden revelations that NSA has an amazing capability for getting into various platforms like routers and PCs and
smartphones and everything, basically,
coming in through your browser and things like that. So even if we did get the right to use strong crypto, if your opponent gets control of your computer, it kind of doesn't matter how good your crypto is, and that's what they're doing. So I don't think that we're going to lose the ability to use strong crypto, but I think that we have to find ways to toughen up the platforms that we're running on. But we got to do more than that. It's not just the technology that we have to fix. We also have to do something in public policy space. And that means we have to push our own governments to recognize that we have a right to privacy, that to refrain from breaking into our computers and intercepting all our communications, to not turn our societies into panopticons. You know, many of the Western democracies have intelligence agencies, foreign intelligence agencies, that are supposed to look outward, that are supposed to spy on other countries, but not on their own citizens. It makes a big difference because, it's like I worry much more in the United States about the NSA than I worry about a foreign government spying on me, because a foreign government can't arrest me. If East Germany still existed, I would not want to have the Stasi spying on me in the United States, but I wouldn't lose any sleep over it because they can't kick my door down in the middle of the night and take me to prison. But if I lived in East Germany, they could. So I'm more sensitive to the domestic abuses of foreign intelligence agencies. But I think that a good question to raise, though, is do we get the kind of world we want to live in when foreign intelligence agencies are spying on the average citizens in other countries? And I don't think anybody's really tried to address this question before. It wasn't until Snowden that we became much more aware that this was going on a grand scale. So I think that allies should try to work through their diplomatic relationships with other countries let's say, Germany and the United States, for example, to ask what kind of relationship do you want to have? I thought we were allies. You're not supposed to spy on our head of state or on our average citizens.
Entire population.
Yeah. On the other hand, if we look at this, I mean, you could look at this from the moral arguments we should make to our governments. But I also find it rather daunting to try to prevent intelligence agencies from doing what's so easy for them to do. You know, you can have laws against things that are difficult to do. I mean, for example, you can have a law against robbing banks and enforce that law because it's hard to rob a bank. But if you had a law against picking your nose, it would not be an effective law. Everybody can pick their nose. Well, the internet has made information so fluid and so easy to intercept that, you know, anybody can intercept the data flowing by, and intelligence agencies can do that also. And so it makes it much more difficult for us to exert enough influence on intelligence agencies to get them to stop doing that, to get them to stop doing what is so easy for them to do. So I find it to be a kind of a daunting challenge, but we can't give up. This is actually much more difficult than the crypto wars of the 1990s. We prevailed in that, but now we have something else, and it's harder. But there have been difficult struggles in the past that were even harder than that. You know, in the U.S., we just had Martin Luther King's birthday this week, and we just had a film come out about what Martin Luther King did in Selma. And it kind of reminded us of the difficulties of the civil rights movement.
What's the name of the movie?
Selma. It's the name of a town in the American South.
That's what the film is called.
Yeah. And it's about the struggles in the early 60s there. And a lot of us imagined at that time that it would be impossible to shake off, you know, the that kind of institutionalized racism. And yet we found a way to bring about big changes. We also ended the arms race. I used to be a peace activist in the 1980s, and we imagined that that would be nearly impossible to stop the arms race, and yet the arms race came to an end. So there have been struggles that seemed to be impossible to overcome in the past, but somehow we overcame them. And even though the one we have now seems so daunting, so difficult to overcome, I think that we can.
Wow. I'm delighted by your optimism. On the other hand, we also had in the times of Martin Luther King, the Citizens Commission to investigate the FBI, and then the Church Committee to investigate what surveillance institutions were doing wrong in the 60s, and then it all got worse. And then we got the Echelon report and the public outcry and a report from European Parliament, and they said we have no place to hide, and then it all got worse. And now we have Snowden, we have a parliamentary inquiry in Germany, but that's about it. I don't yet see real change.
You know, I wouldn't want to underestimate the importance of the Church Committee. It accomplished a lot. The Church Committee was looking at credible abuses by the American intelligence apparatus. And, I mean, they created the FISA courts. Now, we tend to think of the FISA courts as not very much control. But when it was created, right after the Church hearings, the Church Committee, they brought for the first time judicial oversight of the NSA, of, you know, American intelligence. When American intelligence wanted to, you know, wiretap someone in the U.S., they would have to go to the FISA courts. For years, I thought of the FISA courts as just a rubber stamp and didn't really have much respect for them. But as we saw,
they declined 2 requests of 10,000 or so.
Yeah, yeah. But as we saw from what came out after the Snowden revelations and, you know, what the Patriot Act did, it gave me a new appreciation for why it was important to have FISA courts that actually work. They were kind of damaged by the reaction to 9/11. The Patriot Act and the giving the NSA a blank check to do everything they wanted did a great deal of harm to the control that the FISA courts have. So I kind of developed an appreciation for the FISA courts. You know, it sounds funny, but you know, when you get to the point where you appreciate the FISA courts, you know that things have gotten bad. but I don't appreciate the crippled FISA courts that we have now. We need to give them the control that they had before 9/11.
You said we won the first crypto wars and they're not going to take away our ability to use strong crypto. Now, you've also heard the news this week that David Cameron is advocating for no end-to-end communication. Obama apparently joined in a State of the Union address. Now we have the European Commission proposal against strong end-to-end crypto. Do we have a new crypto wars 2 coming up?
I think that today's policymakers perhaps don't remember what it was like in the 90s. We went through the analysis of that decision very carefully. The decision to get end-to-end encryption with strong cryptography was a decision that took years of debate, and everybody was involved in that debate in the U.S. and also in Europe. Journalists, academics, the U.S. judiciary, the U.S. Congress, the FBI, the NSA, to a limited extent. I used to debate NSA people. And privacy advocacy groups. Everybody was involved in that debate. Yeah, and industry. Yeah, the whole computer industry was on our side on this. And even though the FBI never gave up, the NSA backed off, probably because they felt confident that they would find other ways to get what they want. But overall, it was almost a consensus in society that we relax the controls on encryption, the domestic controls in some European countries like France, the export controls of the United States, the export controls in some of the European countries. It was a consensus, or close to a consensus. And we can't turn back the clock. You know, every web browser in the world has SSL that, you know, you go do your online banking. Our mail servers, our mail clients have it, you know, for that. We have disk encryption. You know, the legislative environment today is so much more supportive of strong crypto. If you're a businessman and you leave your laptop in a taxi and that laptop has 200,000 customer identities on it, if you don't have strong encryption of the disk drive, you're in trouble.
You're liable. You'll get sued.
That's right. The laws have changed. In the 1990s, if you were using strong crypto, you had to explain yourself. Today, if you're not using strong crypto, you have to explain yourself. Doctors have to protect patient records with encryption. The aforementioned example of the business guy leaving his laptop in a taxi. You know, in fact, the breach disclosure laws we have in the U.S., they just require us to tell people that their identities have been disclosed. In the U.K., the breach disclosure laws are tougher. It introduces additional civil liabilities and even perhaps criminal sanctions.
But then again, the UK also has cases where they can force people to reveal their encryption passphrases.
Yeah, we've had some cases in the US where that was attempted, and we have managed to hang on to that for a while. We'll see if there's more challenges later. But, you know, we have to keep pushing back. But we have made so much progress. You know, today it is so much easier to use strong crypto and keep the right to use it than it was in the 90s. We're not going to see, just because Cameron made some remarks in a public speech, James Comey, our FBI director, said pretty much the same thing. But
against Apple, when they said they would use default disk encryption on their iOS devices.
Yeah, we can't turn back the clock. Strong crypto, end-to-end encryption, is well entrenched in our economy. We're not going to turn back the clock. We can't, you know. I mean, it's not even feasible to do it, and we're not going to let them.
That is true.
So I'm not too worried about losing the right to use strong crypto. I'm more concerned with the pervasive surveillance that has grown up after 9/11. Certainly, the NSA had powerful capabilities before 9/11, but there were policies, there were policy controls in place. And after 9/11, those policy controls were swept aside. And I think it's done a great deal of harm. The United States has inflicted a lot more, you know, self-inflicted harm than the attacks did.
We've seen the NSA use PGP encrypted messages as a strong selector, and they store them away for as long as they have to until they can decrypt it.
Yeah, maybe sometime later, years later, they might get their hands on the key.
Or find a weakness in some algorithm.
Sure, yeah.
Or work around the endpoint security.
Yeah, Right. At some point in the future, they might break into someone's computer and get the key and then decrypt messages they captured earlier.
But I also see tools like PGP and OTR as credible threats, that if they can't work around the endpoint security, that they cannot break the algorithms themselves.
So that's right.
You did kind of beat the NSA there.
Yes, and they also mentioned ZRTP,
my
protocol for secure telephones.
Yeah.
I'm feeling pretty good about that. One of the Snowden documents talked about what happened many years ago when I announced I was working on a secure telephony project, the ZPhone project. Mm-hmm. And NSA circulated an internal memo, and this the title was, it was an email, you know, the title was, "This can't be good." So even before they looked at ZPhone, even before I had, you know, gotten far in its development, they were already worried. So I'm feeling pretty good about that.
As we know, you did PGP in the 90s and at some point sold it to Symantec. Yesterday you said you had some kind of problems using your PGP.
Oh, yeah.
What's
that
about?
Well, you know, I have a MacBook and the Symantec product doesn't really work that well on current versions of Mac OS. And also, I use the iPad and the iPhone. And I don't have any version of PGP that runs on those. So maybe I can get GNU Privacy Guard to run on my MacBook, but I don't have any candidates to run on my iPad.
So we have the ability to use strong crypto, but we don't have the software to run on the most widely used devices.
Yeah.
Now you're doing Silent Circle, which is also, you did want to also do messaging and telephony, but at some point you dropped the messaging part.
We dropped the email part.
We still do
text messages. We do end-to-end secure text messages, and we do end-to-end secure phone calls. But at the beginning of the company, we were doing secure email, but it wasn't really the architecture that we liked. We stored the keys on the server because all we did was just take an off-the-shelf product, PGP Universal, which is a server-side implementation of PGP. And we weren't very happy with that architecture, but we didn't have any client PGP to run on a mobile device. That's why we were forced to do that. But then LavaBits shut down their email, encrypted email service, because they had a particular customer that was somebody the NSA wanted to get to. And that was right after the Snowden revelations. And there's a widely circulating rumor that maybe it was Snowden, it was the customer that triggered it, but no one knows officially.
The lawyers have been talking about it.
Oh, the lawyers have?
Yeah,
okay,
so.
Well, then I guess they came out with that. Yeah. Anyway, on the very same day that LavaBits shut down their service, we shut down our email encryption service because we anticipated that we were about to get hit with a national security letter, the same as LavaBit.
But you didn't get one, or else you couldn't talk about it?
We did not get one. But we thought we would, like, within hours or the next day. So we shut it down, and we erased all the email without telling our customers in advance. And it was kind of a painful experience.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it also, our customers, some of them were very inconvenienced, but most of our customers actually appreciated it, made them feel that we were committed to their protection.
What is your customer base at the secure telephony and messaging service of Silent Circle? How many users do you have, roughly?
I don't know how many users, but we have probably about 100 countries, people in 100 countries using it. You know, the first
customer... Mostly companies or private people or activists?
Yeah, a lot of companies, private individuals, government users, military users. The guy that I started the company with is Mike Jenke. And Mike is a former Navy SEAL, and he wanted to have something that he could let military people serving overseas phone their families, while they're deployed. And I said, sure, I can help you with that. But I said, I'll help you with this, but on the condition that as soon as we possibly can, let's try to pursue the military market. Because what I wanted to do was to create a situation, a political situation, where if we had a lot of Navy SEALs using it and people in that community, then if the government ever decided to take an interest in trying to put pressure on us to put a back door in, we could stand there and say, no way.
SEALs versus NSA on strong crypto.
I wanted to get them hooked,
Did you succeed?
Well, I tell you, the SEALs would never use our stuff if we had put a back door in. And we, you know, we sell to the special operations forces for Canada, the U.S., Britain, Australia. And none of them would use it if there was a backdoor.
So you're selling to the military of the Five Eyes, and the military secret services of the Five Eyes want to break it?
They really love it, actually. We sell to some law enforcement agencies, too. In fact, one time, I guess it was probably 6 months after we started, or maybe it was a year after we started, the FBI came in. And I was in California at the time, and Mike called me. He said, you know, the FBI was in here today. And I thought, oh no, you know, the pressure's already starting. And he said, no, they were here to ask about pricing.
They're using it too.
Well, I don't know specifically if we sold any to them, but I know we've seen several law enforcement agencies in our office asking about, you know, buying it in quantity. So that was one market I wanted to go after early on. And that, I think that really helped. I think that makes it easier for us politically to resist efforts to put a backdoor in. There haven't been any efforts. They've never asked us for one. But that wasn't our primary market. To me, I saw that as a kind of a political maneuver.
A hack.
Yeah. But the real markets are enterprise. You know, we sell to oil companies, banks, airlines, now movie studios.
I guess which ones?
Well, all the movie studios are very worried,
obviously.
After the Sony thing.
So we have strong crypto, and it's getting even more widely deployed all over the world. And even though some people, like UK prime ministers, want to make some maneuvers against the ability to use strong crypto, you think we're on the winning side and the outlook for the future is good as long as we find some way to deal with the secret services of the world?
Well, I say the outlook for continuing to use strong crypto is good. I think we'll prevail. We'll continue to prevail on that. That we won that one, you know, at the turn of the century. But the other parts, the pervasive surveillance, you know, you can't solve everything just with crypto. Having video cameras everywhere with face recognition algorithms, you can't encrypt your face.
Not yet, but there's makeup.
Yeah, but that's silly. You know, people are not going to wear makeup when they walk down the street. We need to do something to address the pervasive surveillance problem.
One last question. Have you seen Citizen 4?
Oh, yes.
In the credits, there was GNU-PG, and PGP mentioned. How did that make you feel? Laura Poitras said, without PGP, Snowden would never have happened.
Yeah, I was glad to see that. I want to see whistleblowers using strong crypto. It's very risky for whistleblowers to come forth. You know, I gave a talk at Bletchley Park a few years ago, and it's a museum now. Bletchley Park was the place in England where they broke the German Enigma code in World War II. And that's where Alan Turing worked. And I noticed that they had thousands of people working there, and yet none of them were leaking information because they all understood the moral importance of the work they were doing. They were getting bombed every night by the Luftwaffe. They recognized that the work they were doing was important to protect freedom. And so no one was tempted to leak information. There were no whistleblowers. For there to be whistleblowers like how many we're seeing now from NSA, that can only come when people who work at NSA recognize that something is wrong. There's something that isn't right about what's going on. And that's what creates whistleblowers. So when you do a side-by-side comparison between Bletchley Park and the NSA having so many whistleblowers right now, back before 9/11, you didn't see anybody leaking stuff from NSA because the NSA was pretty much a foreign intelligence agency working in the Cold War, you know, pretty much focusing their attention on, you know, Soviet military communications and, you know, Soviet diplomatic communications and things of that nature, Eastern Bloc countries, governments. It's only really in recent years that we've seen the NSA doing behaviors that encourage whistleblowers.
Let's hope we can fix those situations.
Yeah.
Phil Zimmerman, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us. Thanks for all the work you've done on PGP, CTRP, and Silent Circle, and enjoy the rest of your time at CPDP.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you.